Hello, everybody, and welcome to Awakenings. Awakenings is a podcast that invites us all to share a wider story of the human family. We're delighted to be in conversation with leading systems thinkers as we ask ourselves this question as leaders, as people, how do we navigate a crisis of such magnitude that it threatens our existence? What will our legacy be for our human family? We'll be looking at the roots, really, of how we ended up here, in the context of how we use that learning, this wider story, to help us shape a brighter future, to change the choices that we make for the world that we want to have. I'd very much like to acknowledge our elders, our ancestors, the people who in some ways suffered greatly. But if we can learn from their experiences, we can transform that into something that will light us really forward to a much brighter path. I'd also really like to recognise Foundation Nova Diem for their huge generosity in making this podcast possible. Thank you to all of you, and thank you for listening. Hi, everyone. It's just so lovely to be here for another episode, or for actually our first episode today of Awakenings, where we actually try to look at the interconnections between colonisation, climate change, and how we actually can move forward. Today's episode is Troubled Roots, Hopeful Road, and I'm so delighted to have on the show this morning Christine McDougall, who's the founder of Syntropic World. And the reason I'm so happy to have Christine in this context is while we'll be looking at the troubled roots, how we got here, Christine's work is incredible in Syntropic Road and really does give us that hope, that framework for how we can build a world with a future. Christine is a seasoned executive coach and facilitator. She's had a remarkable career spanning two decades. She made history as the first non-USA-based board member of the Global Board of International Coach Federations. But more, she's worked with very prestigious clients, ANZ, NAB, Westpac, Nokia. But more impressively is the incredible work that she's been doing lately with Syntropic World, which is creating businesses for a world with a future where integrity, multiple domains of value, human connection and well-being are honoured on the balance sheet. So really delighted to have you with us here this morning, Christine.
No, thank you, Cindy. It's always a joy just actually hanging out with you as somebody I know and treasure and love over a number of years. So thank you.
Well, I'm delighted, yeah.
So I wanted, you know, I have known you and loved the fierce and beautiful spirit that you hold and nurture both through your lineage and also your activism, you know, very admirable qualities of not just sitting on the sidelines and watching the things that humans, the horrible things that humans do to the world, but actively engaging to the point of finding yourself in a courtroom with police and all of that sort of stuff in your younger years. So I was really interested in this exploration around colonization and climate change. And I wondered if you could give me a broad brush background to colonization, remembering, of course, that it's a multidimensional and impossible to explain in a soundbite. So we have a soundbite moment, but how would you set the scene for this conversation?
Yeah, well, thanks so much, Christine, for acknowledging that. It is a lot to get into a soundbite, but I mean, I'll try my best. I mean, essentially, colonization is the pursuit, you know, the extraction of resources for the benefit of one group to the detriment of another. And what we saw in the European colonizing project that took off in the late 1400s, you know, the 1400s onwards, it was also a massive terraforming exercise. Now, what I mean by that is it disrupted the ecosystems of the planet so massively that I think Earth, part of our problems are rooted in that, let alone what actually happened to the people. So what I mean by terraforming is that if you imagine the continent of South America and the USA, that's about a quarter of Earth's landmass. That was completely disrupted. And we'll look at how in a minute. The British Empire alone covered almost at one point a quarter of the world. You've got the whole of Africa that's been carved up by different European colonies. You've got most actually every single country in Southeast Asia except for Thailand. So you've got these huge tracts of Australia, Canada, of Earth surface that the original ecosystems that were, you know, these were not virgin lands. There were people, very heavily populated lands, people, but working within the natural systems. These were ripped out to create, to replicate for the settled countries like Canada, Australia, and USA. They were ripped out to create the, replicate the European farming systems as well as the plantations that went in. I don't just mean the sugar plantations, the tobacco plantations. I mean, they were plantation economies. And then you've also got the other areas that we've mentioned. They're now just being used. They're being seen almost purely as places that you can extract raw materials from. So they go from being lands that are cared for by their people to lands that are just being plundered. So you've got deforestation, you've got biodiversity loss, you've got the pollution that came with the industrialization, the increased pollution of the air, the water, the soil. You've got the desertification that happens because, you know, for example, in Africa, the people were told to stop their subsistence farming methods that actually were in balance with the land, and they now had to just create these plantation economies that, you know, was the roots of a lot of the desertification in the African country. So you've had this whole scale, and then as it goes on, you get everything from, you know, ripping out the original ecosystems to dreadful things that happened in Vietnam, for example, like letting off Agent Orange to, you know, to maintain the colony of Vietnam. So you've really got this incredible body blow to Earth's natural systems. And that's what we talk about terraforming it, turning it into something that it never was. And with that, of course, came the ripping out of the people. And that's, and they were the people that knew how to steward the land, and the scale of those genocides, Christine, is, you know, it's you can hardly breathe sometimes when you think about it. People, you know, think that these were, that the myth is that these were virgin lands that were there for the taking. But on the continent of America alone, the estimate of the population pre-Columbian was somewhere between 75 million and 114 million. And nearly every single country that was colonized in the North and the South Americas had a 96, be somewhere between a 90 to a 96% population loss. Places like Haiti, Cuba, people, the whole indigenous populations went extinct. So those were the people that did have the knowledge to live in harmony with the land. And they were then, with them went the knowledge of, you know, that had kept those land systems in balance for tens of thousands of years. So it was really a massive disruption to Earth's ability to function, as well as the human loss of knowledge that we had to live compatibly with Earth. Yeah.
Wowza. It is very hard actually to take in one, even the soundbite that you've given. It's just so hard to even comprehend a lot of what you're saying, and the incredible destruction of ecosystems and humans and cultures and way of being, and the, you know, the personal emotional reconciliation that comes with that, which is very hard. I think for anyone to ingest in one little piece. So can you tell me why this work matters to you, both from the personal and the systemic level, and why do you think, or maybe you don't, but, you know, why do we need to confront the history, the truth of this bloody and horrendous colonization?
Well, thanks again, Christina. It is really hard, even speaking of it. I can feel my heart beating. It's so hard. And I think for all of us as a human family, some of us with our heritage, we know more because we lived through it, or our ancestors did, or our parents, you know, certainly in my case. But some people, it's been buried, but it's kind of there. The knowledge is there, but it's the kind of thing you slam the lid down on. So it's very hard for us as a human family to come to terms with this. But I think it's really critical that we do, because in the understanding of what's happened, if we actually, I love that quote from Ben Okri, we can only create a future from the the depth of the truth we face now, I think we have to look at how we got here so that we can understand how to get out. And not only in the case of colonization, how did we, what happened, but also what happened to enable us to think that this was okay, to justify this type of behavior. So this goes in, and again, it's, you know, this is a big topic with a small amount of time to talk about it, but this does go into the whole framing of the dominant narrative. We've got philosophies of the Enlightenment, for example, like the Enlightenment, you know, Kant, who was referred to as the Age of Reason. But was it really that reasonable? You know, you're talking about ideas of liberty, of freedom that come to light in this era at the same time as the colonizing project is going on. But what it really meant was only for the very few. It was a colony that favored entirely hierarchically the white male race and the elite of that race as well. So really what you're calling reasonable is to say only a tiny percentage of living things, humans and others, have any right to a quality of life. This justified the fact that you were on the civilizing mission, the white man's burden, the manifest destiny. The whole philosophy of the time was shaped to say it's this is what we need to be doing. This is our destiny. This is the work of God, which is a really psychological deformation of ourselves. It's backed up, you know, you've got people like Francis Bacon saying, you know, we must take nature by the forelock and subdue her. You've got this Cartesian mechanistic worldview that's saying Earth is just a set of random parts that can be used as resources. You've got the science of the time, poor Charles Darwin with his, you know, his work that's not what he said, but the interpretation of the survival of the fittest, again, is this license to go and, you know, subdue these inferior races who must be exterminate the brutes, who must be, you know, must be, there's so many statesmen of the time that we need to do this. These races will go extinct. It's the natural order of things. So there's a whole psychological job that's been done on us to make us believe that it was, you know, to the dominant narrative that sets the frame to justify this behavior. And it's really brutal. I can't go into more detail here because it would take time. But I think it's so important that we recognize that, because that's still the dominant narrative that drives the capitalist death machine, if you like, or the First Nations people call it Wetiko. They recognize this horrible, they couldn't believe what they were seeing when they saw the destruction of their lands. And they said, you know, this must be some terrible disease. It's a disease of greed. It's hugely contagious. We can see it's affecting everybody it touches, and it's destroyed our world, and it will destroy on a much wider scale. So in recognizing that, we can see the roots of our, you know, of what's happened to us, and then understand how we can reframe and look at the world differently. Just as, I mean, I've used this analogy before, I borrowed it from Kate Raworth when she says, you know, when Ptolemy's looking and all people can see is Earth at the center of the solar system, and then Copernicus comes along and says, actually, hold on a minute, it's the other way around. And I think that's what we need to look at now. We have to step outside of those really damaging frames and say, how do we live now collaboratively here? How do we step outside of that model? And that's why I think it's so important to confront what's happened to us, Christine, so that we can understand how to reshape our minds to live in a way that is much more syntropic, which I'm so delighted to be talking to you in a minute about what that actually means. Yeah.
Yeah, it's and it is hard to confront. So, you know, as long as I've known you, you've been incredibly passionate about Earth-led education and changing our relationship to nature, Earth, and our future. So what do you see is the entanglements between colonization and the climate change efforts? Well, let me say it in another way. In most of the current narrative, it is focused on climate change, and there is a disrelationship between what you're speaking about with colonization and that bloody horrid history. So why is it so important that we actually see the two as I'm hearing it, completely interlinked?
Yeah, well, you know, again, thanks for a very good question. I think it's critical. I mean, I think, you know, people tend, the science, modern science has been brilliant in some ways, but it's tend to split everything off into its silos. So we're looking at the amount of carbon, we're looking at the, you know, it's always these, but we are an interconnected ecosystem with a very, very long history. So to try to find the solutions in just one little component part isn't going to give us the bigger, fortunately, this is being understood for the first time. The IPCC report in 2022, it's taken 30 years, actually gave colonization as the one of the roots of climate change. So, it's, you know, there is the recognition. And I think that's really critical, because unless we acknowledge that, even beyond the philosophies that I've talked about, you won't understand what the solutions look like, because the extraction that continues today from the global south, I don't have the stats at my fingers, but I think it's 80% of wealth still comes out of the global south to the global north compared to what's received. They're stuck with the loans from the IMF, the World Bank, in this system of debt bondage. And it's just not possible for companies at the countries, the neo-colonialist, the colonization isn't over. The model just stays the same. It's just large oil companies, cocoa companies, whatever resource extraction companies that have taken the place, of countries in this colonized model. So you're still getting this massive extraction coming out of the global south. You're getting the impact of the resources, of the emissions, are hitting the global south worse than far more severely than the global north. So unless you recognize what's happening there, you can't understand adequate solutions. You've got things like reparations, loss and damage, debt jubilees, all of which will really need to happen to rebalance us as a human family. So instead of these being fringe solutions and outliers, they need to move to the core, because if not, you're just tinkering around the edges of something that's never going to make the systemic rebalancing that we need to walk out of this with some degree of hope of getting out of the situation we're in now as a human family. So it's really critical that we acknowledge that. So on that note of hope, Christine, I would love to turn to talk to now you about what you do, because I think that's so much what your work, when I've said, this is how we got here. This is why we need to move forward. But how actually can and should we do that? So can you give me an overview of Centropic World and its purpose? Hey, I know, again, it's a complex work, and this is going to need to be soundbited, but how can it be effective in helping us recognize the imprint of colonization in our worldview and our personal and organizational practices today?
Well, thank you, Cindy, for that. Because everything you were saying, there's so many linkages that I hadn't even seen before until this conversation. So I go to the substrate of the work of Centropic World, which is kind of the background that it was birthed in, at the intersection of two key places. I was trained in integrative medicine, really, which is a different discipline of looking at, instead of looking at the symptom, we look at the whole, and not just the whole, but the whole in context and in relationship to the environment in which the whole is operating. So there was that intersection. And then there was another intersection at the same time. I was introduced to the work of Buckminster Fuller. He has been a sort of steadfast mentor of mine for most of my life. But one of the most incredibly fascinating pieces around Bucky's work was that the principle of synergy, which means that we've got to start looking at the whole. The behavior of the whole cannot be determined by an examination of the parts separately. And so his discipline included looking at our history of power, the global trade routes, energy, the currency of energy, the hegemonic forces that wanted to dominate the supply chains. And he didn't directly address colonization in the brutality, but he addressed it as an overall sort of systems change perspective, and covered everything from the financial system, really, really speaking about how humans engage with power over, but also energy as power for domination. And the underlying thread of his work that inspired me so much was, how do we create a world that works for Earth and all her creatures without ecological offense or the disadvantage of anyone? and the question that sits behind that, as well as a deeper question, which says, you know, what is the purpose of humans in universe? And how do we partner with universe? So this, from this sort of substrate of my, in my 20s and all of the different experiences that I've had, I reached a conclusion that to try and fix the broken system, the systems that do exactly the things that you've talked about, the systems, and there is a great term coined by a few people, but Scott Alexander wrote a wonderful piece on Moloch, you know, this system that we live in that we don't see because it's invisible and weightless and immeasurable, but we know it because a really simple example of a Molochian impulse is the arms race. You know, if I have nuclear, then you need nuclear. And it escalates on escalates on escalates. And there's no sort of limiting effect around that. Or at a more simple human experience, if we're at a concert and someone at the front stands up and they refuse to sit down, then everyone stands up and everyone loses. And so the Molochian impulse, which is complex and systemic, is a win-lose game. And so I wanted to take the work of Bucky Fuller, and he was very, very committed over the course of his life to applying what he called nature's coordinate systems. So in other words, how nature works to enterprise, and he mostly applied it to the built environment, and he was considering the all-in accounting cost of a barrel of oil back in 1927, this type of thinking that if we applied that today, we know without question that pretty much not a single company on the planet would be profitable because we're not accounting for nature and Earth and her work and her investment and so on. We're not accounting for any of the after effects of that. And so I knew that there had to be a different way, and it was more, was I interested in investing my time in trying to fix the broken or build new models? And quite frankly, they're not new models, actually. They're actually models that are there for all of us. They've been there working all the time. I have a Western scientific language set that speaks to that, but if they're true, then they will be isomorphic with Indigenous wisdom, Indigenous knowledge, with care and love for the earth and so on, because rather than humans engaging in universe as dominating, extractive, exploitative beings, how do we partner with, how do we enable ecologies of synergy where we're better together as a result of our work, essentially breaking down every single framework that we have about what it means to be human in universe, from working to how we consider value, how we engage with each other. So it's a complete rethinking of everything. That's Centropic World. At the high level, at the very ground level, it is stewardship, building, bringing people together from diverse backgrounds and enabling them to work well together in their bringing both their unique agentic selves into community, and at the core, holding the sacredness of life to everything that we do. And yeah, so it's a all systems approach with a very granular, practical, grounded experience of how humans be with each other, the earth, our future.
Well, thanks so much, Christy. I mean, it does make, when you know, listening to you, and I've been had the privilege to attend many of your courses and your classes, it just makes absolute sense. It is one of those earth is round moments yet again, when you're just thinking, gosh, how can we be looking at these disconnected things? How do we have this one vector, one measure of value, GDP, one vector of progress, power? It's when you talked about the big picture and then moving to the granular, how can a company engage with Centropic practice? Because this is the thing, the ideas sound great, got it, we need to actually change how we value, how we measure value in all dimensions, but what does that actually look like for a company? How can a company engage with Syntropic practice? Do you need to build something new from the beginning, or can Syntropic design help you turn around the ship that you're already in, if you like, the design that you already have?
Yeah, and so in the very simple form and applicable to almost every business, enterprise, partnership, team, project, is human coordination. So how we bring diverse people together and make things that matter. And there is an architecture to that. It's not a random crapshoot. There is actually a design element. Geometry is the study of relationships. That's what the term means. And so there is a geometry to human relational design that works. And most of us have had some experience of this because we might have been on teams or projects where there is a hum and a harmonic and a beautiful polarity that enables us all to thrive together, even in that tension. But it's not a random thing. It's actually, there's actually thoughtful, considered, elegant design that lives behind that. So at the very practical level, that's a starting place. There is also the transition of our being in leadership from being leader as dominator to being leader as steward. And so stewardship is a very different principle. It's kind of like parenting. This child or this idea or this company or this project isn't ours. We're there to create this environment for that to flourish and come to its fullest possibility. That's very different, a very different relationship than the leadership relationship that we see, the leadership position that we have as the dominator, as the power, and so on. How do we engage with value? How do we hold that there is to be an intention and an honoring towards zero exploitation of anyone or anything as a new frame of being that we cannot extract to extinction, and that colonizing at the human level, which is coming in and taking your idea or your IP or your beauty or your project or design work and claiming it as ours, you know, that's another form of, that's the interior sort of colonization, that these things are morally and integrous, from an integrity point of view, anti-life and anti-in-service of beauty and goodness and future. And so at the very simple level, those are the things that any company who's interested in any of those things can engage in. At the more systemic level, for those enterprises and companies that are genuinely interested in stewarding a world in service to the sacredness of life, then it's a much more whole systems approach. And, you know, I have learned that it's not for me to judge one or the other, because once we start applying the nature's coordinate systems, once we start partnering with nature's design principles in how we do everything, rather than imposing a human construct over and hoping for a better outcome, then we start applying all of the principles. So it's you know, at one level, it doesn't really matter if we start from let's get our team to be an extraordinary synergistic team, or let's recalibrate our relationship to value so that the person with the money isn't given the high seat at the table, whereas the person who cares about the team and keeps it together is regarded as lesser than. If those, you know, those are some of the things that we can start with, but if we begin to apply those things, then we're actually changing the whole.
Yeah, I see that. I mean, there is a real urgency with this kind of work, given that, you know, what I think what you said, you know, work that is in support of life. The model that we have at the moment, ironically, is it's the model that everybody thinks is the only one, but it's the one that's fueling our demise. This endless growth model, this dominator model, this extractive extinction that you've so clearly outlined there, Christine. So it feels that there's a real urgency for this kind of work. And, you know, you really have developed one of the most powerful frameworks. I mean, I've worked in this space, as you know, for over 25 years, and you've developed one of the most powerful frameworks I've encountered for making systemic change, that systemic shift that we have to have now in how we value things, that connects the web of colonization, environmental systems collapse, monetary policy, all these things, and puts the tools in our hands to address these while creating enterprises where all stakeholders can thrive, including the natural world stakeholders. So how did you come to evolve this model? It's so remarkable. How did you come to evolve it? And how do you plan to get this work into the wider world at this time when we so critically need it? And what can we do to be part of supporting that to happen?
Yeah, thank you. As a dedicated student of Bucky Fuller's work, it's about application. So he would say, build the model, argue with the model. And so there's very profoundly applicable work. There's a lot of theory, but it's where I love the intersection of this is when we apply it. And so I got to practice in coaching and facilitating in executive teams and giving people like bankers an introduction to some of this material for the last 25 years. And rather than have them look at me as if I was some oddball whatever, because what we're teaching in Centropic World is the way life works all of the time, it's not magical or weird. It's actually really, it just makes sense. You know, it lands for people because we're engaging with it all of the time. It's just that we've never thought about things like that. And my experience as well is that most people that I've met, most people are genuinely interested in doing the right thing for a world with a future. They're genuinely interested in doing great work, in contribution, in leaving the world better. But that's not the operating system that we live in. Mm. And because the operating system that we live in is so entrenched and so invisible to us, it's almost impossible. You have to see it. It's like you have to see the history of colonization. You have to see that. You have to confront it first before you can go, oh, we have to reconcile this piece and we can't keep doing this because for a number of reasons, we're not going to make it as humans, but also because we have to stop treating each other like this. You know, we have to start treating humans like this and start valuing the profound gifts that every life has to offer. And so in my experience, there is a genuine hunger and a genuine desire for something that really honors the sacredness of life, that really gives people the opportunity to bring their unique and whole selves into a project or team or community and work together in a way that enables the collective outcome to be far more powerful than anyone could imagine. People are yearning for this type of thing. So, you know, I was playing and practicing with different ways of doing this for a long time. And it just got to the point where I couldn't do anything else, first and foremost, and that the outcomes were so incredible for people and the experience that we had to sort of like take it into the world. And, you know, I believe that because there is such a hunger and we want the work to speak for itself. So this is, you know, build the model, argue with the model. So my commitment at this point in time is to support as many people and enterprises and teams and projects and communities and families even out there in the world who care enough about a world with a future and that we leave the world better than we started, which we're not doing very well at all, and that they apply this and the model speaks for itself. So it's been a very grassroots effort to this point so that we can build up enough models that that speak for themselves. And I believe, you know, when like all things worth growing against a growth to death current model, this will flourish because people are looking for something and our current system is highly likely to collapse. And I would like to have examples of what's possible on the other side of that.
Yeah, that's absolutely fascinating and brilliant, Christine. I think you're so right. People are really looking for something, but there's this absolute hesitancy almost to believe that something else can exist because we're so indoctrinated almost to believe that the current model that we have is the only model. So, you know, but it's really fascinating times because we can see that now that, you know, we're getting this huge message from Mother Nature saying, I don't think so. You know, this just isn't working. It's out of alignment with the planetary boundaries. You're going to have to rethink how you do things if you want to have the carry on being here. So I think it's really fantastic that you're evolving this at that. You know, it's funny, things sometimes emerge at the time that they're needed, don't they? I mean, I feel that you're right. There have been other models all the way through. You've mentioned indigenous models, how people lived, you know, before this became the only thing that we can imagine. But yeah, I just think it's absolutely fantastic work. So how can we support you in making sure that this has a wide platform, that people know that it's there, that they can have the invitation to come and be part of what you're doing?
Well, thank you for that question, Cindy. So the Syntropic World, you know, we have both a teaching platform and a community of practice, and they go together. And so people can enter through taking different classes. The Syntropic Masterclass is kind of the foundational program because we cover the basics. It is a relanguaging. I'm also very passionate about new language for a new world. So there's a relanguaging, rethinking. It's not something that you can get taking one masterclass, which is why we offer people to come back and repeat the masterclass for no additional fee at this time, because it is a lot, and it's kind of like layers. You go through the layers of the first iteration and it arises, you know, it's very similar actually to the unpicking of our colonized mindset. It's a process. No one gets there in the first round. I'm working with it all the time. And so there's the opportunity for classes and then community of practice, which is where we can support each other, because we need to support each other. I mean, you can't do this on your own. And there are definitely going to be obstacles in the way. I'm not naive about any of that sort of thing. And the current system is is so powerful and very hell-bent on maintaining itself. And so that's another reason why we do this in stealth mode at the moment, because until there is enough mass, there's no point going out all guns blazing. That's a terrible term I just said. it's no point going out all bugles blaring on sound and going, here we are, we're the greatest, and we have the whatever. This isn't even a solutionist sort of thing, because I think there's an issue with that as well. This is really about us remembering, reanimating, respecting, partnering with the laws that we're familiar with every day, like, you know, like gravity and stuff like that. And so and so people can engage in sort of different ways. We are very open about making this an opportunity that if anyone is genuine and they would like to partake in any of the classes, we do invite scholarships for those, because I'm very, very clear from the beginning that there are people who don't have the financial means payment. We have other methods of taking that into account, which is part of the models that we teach, like synergistic accounting. But it is anyone who is genuinely interested in participating is allowed access. And those who can pay, that helps, because we do live in a world where money is the currency of livelihood. And for us to get this work out into the world, we need that. So, yeah, that's – and then as an experience on the other side of that can become a part of the centropic community and get the support needed to build, apply, learn. It's both an interior, learn our own interior development and our exterior building into the world and the support that you need around that. So I guess that's it.
Yeah, well, I'm so delighted. You know, I've benefited hugely from your wisdom, Christine, from the support that you've given me in helping to build my own endeavors. And I think that, you know, the challenge is it's so incredible. It's so the biggest block is our own belief, isn't it? If we believe that we can think and do things differently, then we can think and do things differently. So I think that what you're doing, supporting people to be able to take those steps and actually start creating a different model is just one of the, as I say, one of the most powerful things that I'm aware of happening at the moment, and with such roots in such, you know, in such strong grounded universal principles. So it always gives me such delight to spend time with you, Christine. You're like, you know, you are your own power pack. It's a blast of the most beautiful solar energy spending time speaking to you. So thank you so much for joining us this morning and for all the amazing centropic work that you're doing for our world.
Thank you, Cindy. And I am so excited about this particular podcast and getting the message that you're bringing around colonization and climate change into the world, because we all need to confront how we've been and so that we can create a better world. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much, Christine. And thanks to everybody for joining us today. You've been listening to the Awakenings podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please do share the podcast, and you can visit my website. It's www.cindyford.com. I'd like to thank everybody who's been part of this, our wonderful systems thinkers who have joined us. And I'd really like a special thanks to go to Foundation Nova Diem, who've made this podcast possible. It's been such a pleasure to share this time with you. Thank you so much for listening.